Well, I'm delighted to welcome you back. We are continuing our studies of the letter of Paul to the Romans. Last time we were together, we were taking a look at the context of this letter. We were noticing that Paul writes it from the city of Corinth. He was on his third missionary journey. He's anticipating, of course, that he's going to be visiting the Roman church in the not too distant future. He's wanting to address himself throughout this letter to what is probably the most significant and raging debate that is part of the life of the church at the time, and that is this entire question of how Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians are going to relate to each other. And the great truth of the book of Romans really comes down to the idea that we all come to God together on the basis of the free gift that God has given to us in Christ, which is received through that transaction that we call faith. And so it's going to be a discussion of faith throughout. And we find, of course, that Paul sets that thesis forth in the first big statement, really, that he makes in the book, the thesis statement, really, for the book, which is found in chapter 1, beginning at verse 16. Paul says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith." Not faith plus something, not some kind of preliminary preparation that disposes me to be a proper recipient of the gift through faith, but it's simply faith. To everyone who has faith. And notice immediately he makes this comparison for the Jew first, but also for the Greek. For it is the righteousness of God is revealed through faith, for faith, as it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith. It is faith at the beginning, it's faith at the end, it is faith throughout, it is faith. And faith becomes the mechanism, the means, whereby this great gift of righteousness is conveyed to us. He says it's to the Jew first, because, of course, it was throughout history, first to the Jew. But that is not to say in terms of priority or some kind of additional importance, simply in terms of chronology. It came to the Jew first. And throughout Paul's life, throughout his career, he would first go to the Jews. It was appropriate that he should do so. When he arrives in any given town, if they have a synagogue, he goes first to the synagogue, first to the Jew. They would be the natural missionaries. They would be the one who more than anyone else would be predisposed to receive the gospel and carry it out to the Gentile world. Always first to the Jew, but not to the exclusion of the Gentile. And the fact of the matter is that whether Jew or Gentile, all people are eventually going to come to God by faith. And there's not going to be some sort of special status that's accorded to some as opposed to others. And that's really the great thesis statement that Paul wants to make for this book. And that's the statement we're going to use as the initial thought from which we'll proceed right after we have a word of prayer. Great God in heaven, we are grateful to you for your mercies to us. And we pray now that as we give attention to the words of the apostle, that the same Spirit that guided his pen would be present with us to give us an understanding of these words, and that we would not only hear them with our minds, but hear them with our hearts and be touched and changed on the basis of this, asking these things in the name of Christ. Amen. It seems to me as you survey the entire book of Romans, you could say that there's a preliminary distinction that we could make right off the bat between two great sort of sections of the book. The first is rather short, the second is much longer. We usually think of the book of Romans as a book that is all about the gospel, and that is true. The fundamental meaning of that word gospel in the English language, Godspell, is its original derivation from the Saxon language, but it actually translates the Greek word euangelion, the eu evangel, the you message, the good message, or the good news. And so when we think about the gospel, we're of course thinking primarily about something that we conceive of as the good news. of God. But the very fact that we talk about good news implies that there must have been some other news. There must have been some news that wasn't so good. And so the preliminary distinction I'd like to make in the basic organization of this book is to first of all think of the good news, but before that, there is the bad news. And the first part of the book of Romans is really an attempt to spell out for us the bad news. The bad news, I believe, really starts in verse 18 of chapter 1 with that powerful word, wrath. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven. And that bad news discussion goes all the way over to chapter 3, verse 20, where finally Paul concludes with this remarkable and powerful statement that all people, whether Jew or Gentile, regardless of their status, regardless of their birth, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of where they live in the world, or what their skin color happens to be, or what language they speak, or any other of the criteria that we sometimes use to differentiate one from the other, in spite of all of that, we are all under sin. We are all guilty. We are all exposed to this wrath of God that Paul has announced in verse 18 of chapter 1. And on the basis of that, we can all can come together, regardless of whether Jew or Greek, regardless of any of these different categories in which we might place ourselves, and say that together, as one united human race, we are in trouble. There is bad news that really discusses or covers all of us. And that's the first section that Paul, or the first topic that Paul takes up, and he really takes it up in verse 18. So, right now, we're thinking of the first section of the book, verse 18 of chapter 1 to verse 20 of chapter 3, and I'm calling it by the overall heading, Bad News. Now, we could take that bad news section and divide it right down the middle and say that there is bad news that describes those who are what I will call the outsiders, and then there is bad news that describes those who I would call the insiders. So the outsiders, otherwise known as the Gentiles, which is probably by far most of those who are here with me today or watching this by video, the bad news, the Gentiles, are those who are described by Paul beginning at verse 118 and going through chapter 2, verse 16. Then in verse 17, you'll notice Paul raises this question, verse 17, chapter 2, if you call yourself a Jew. And he really gives us the message at that point that now he's shifting his focus. And for the rest of this bad news section, he's going to be addressing his thoughts primarily to those who call themselves Jews and saying with respect to them that they are in the same trouble, in fact, in some ways, maybe worse trouble. The bad news applies to them as well. And so we have a discussion addressed to Gentiles and then a discussion addressed to Jews. But in either case, start to finish, the news is bad. So let's take a look at it. We're going to address ourselves, first of all, to this section that begins at verse 118 and goes through 216. This is bad news applying to the Gentiles, the outsiders, those who are not necessarily exposed to the Word of God or the message of His redemptive activity in history. This section itself can be, I think, organized according to what I like to call the three R's. You may know that traditionally in American education there were the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and that still applies, I suppose. But the three R's that I have in mind here are slightly different, but hopefully this will help you remember them. They are the three words, first of all, revelation, secondly, rebellion, thirdly, retribution. Those are the three R's of this bad news section of Romans. The first one is revelation. And this is the discussion that Paul takes up for us beginning at verse 118. So I'd like to read this with you, and then we'll have a brief discussion of its basic content. So beginning at verse 18 of chapter 1 of Romans, the wrath of God is revealed, revelation, from heaven against all the ungodliness and wickedness of those who by their wickedness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them ever since the creation of the world. His invisible power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood, seen through the things He's made. So they're without excuse. For though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him. But they became futile in their thinking. Their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal human beings or birds or four-footed animals or reptiles. Well, it's hard to imagine Paul being able to make himself any more clear than he does right here. What has he said? The wrath of God is revealed. That's the first thing we know. It's revelation. The fact that God is angry with respect to human sinfulness is not a great secret concealed in heaven, but is a great truth revealed from heaven, and people know it. Paul isn't at this point saying that people know it by reading the Bible, or people know it by engaging in some kind of religious inquiry. They simply know it. It's plain to them, Paul says. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven. The fact that God is not happy with human sin is something revealed. It's revealed with respect to our ungodliness, that is, our inner disposition of irreverence, coupled with our wickedness, which is the external behavior that is the expression of that inward act of rebellion against God. And rather than facing up to that, rather than acknowledging that we are in this hostile relationship with God, we suppress it. What Paul means by that is we simply refuse to face it. We refuse to acknowledge it. This is what is sometimes called denial. People are able to act in a way that represents denial of what they know. Human beings have that capacity. We are able to face a conspicuous fact and simply deny it. And it seems that fundamentally, in a theological way, that's exactly what we're doing. Paul continues, what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. This is not a great secret. It's not something that requires some sort of deep philosophical speculation, some penetrating analysis of obscure points of arcane philosophical thought. No, God has made it plain to them. Every living human being, regardless of where they live, regardless of what their theological or religious background might be, regardless of what is otherwise their available information, has had this made plain to them. What can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. God has shown it. He has become their instructor. God is their teacher. And God has taught this information to them. And Paul says later, they've gotten it so well that they have no excuse. This is what's commonly called in traditional Christian teaching, general revelation. You may know that there's a differentiation on the subject of revelation between two kinds. Revelation comes in two flavors. There is general revelation, which is revelation that God gives generally to everybody, and it is general information about God. You don't learn necessarily about the Trinity. You don't learn about the atonement of Christ. These things are not part of the content of general revelation. But that there is information, and it is true information, that is learned about God simply by this general revelation is perfectly clear in terms of the biblical teaching. The idea that God is, the idea that God is holy, the idea that God is the Creator, the idea that we are responsible before God and that there is a moral obligation that we have before this God would be part of the content of general revelation. Special revelation is that which comes through the Scriptures, that which uses words, much more full-orbed information. But the point Paul's driving out here is that even on the basis of general revelation, people know enough to be deprived of the excuse of ignorance. They can't stand before God on judgment and say, boy, if I'd known you were there, God, I would have worshipped you. You see, I never heard of you. I didn't know you were there. I had no idea that there was this obligation. that was incumbent upon me to worship you, and therefore I'm excused based on ignorance. Paul is depriving everybody of the excuse of ignorance. There is no excuse. As he says, that which may be known of God is plain to them ever since the creation of the world. His invisible power and divine nature, though invisible, he says, are understood and seen through what he has made. There's always been a little bit of a debate among Christian people as to whether Paul is referring here to the knowledge that comes to us through the external order of nature, the natural order that we see around us, or whether he's referring to inward nature, the nature of the human understanding when looking within. Certainly in chapter 2 of Romans, Paul is going to make express reference to the knowledge of God or the law of God written on their hearts. That would be a kind of inward knowledge of God. But here in chapter 1, he seems to be referring more to the external order. It's reminiscent of what the psalmist says back in Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The earth displays his handiwork. Night after night, day after day, their speech utters the truth of God. And we certainly have some idea that there is this great argument for God that comes through the external created order. And it does seem in chapter 1 that that is more the idea that Paul has in mind, that ever since the creation, his invisible, powerful qualities have been seen. His eternal power, that is, that he's powerful, that he's eternal, that he's the creator, that he is deity, that he is not some kind of creation. All of this, Paul seems to say, is coming to us thunderingly, clearly, through that which he has made. John Calvin, the great theologian of the Reformation, says, "We walk blindfolded through a magnificent theater that is constantly declaring forth to us the great truth of God, surrounded with it, and yet somehow we turned a blind eye to it." This is not a failing of the information, it's a failing of the moral disposition of the heart. We refuse to see it. It's not that we're unable to, it's that we're unwilling to. And for that, Paul says, we will be held responsible. At verse 20, he says, "They are without excuse, because though they knew God, they refused to honor him. They refused to give him thanks. And by so doing, they plunge themselves into futility of thinking, senseless minds darkened." I think you can understand that when people begin to reason by refusing to acknowledge what they know to be true, that every logical deduction that they may draw from that point on is going to be faulty at its heart. If I refuse to acknowledge what I know to be true, I may reason perfectly from that point on. But if my assumptions are all bad, all have a kind of fault line that runs down the middle of them, then all of the reasoning that I may carry on from that point is going to have some deep and profound problem, because I've started by refusing to acknowledge what I knew to be true. And Paul, in some sense, is saying that's what the entire human race does. They may reason brilliantly. Reasoning can be brilliant, but foolish. Foolish brilliance. And people engage in all kinds of brilliant foolishness all the time because they refuse to acknowledge, Paul says, what they know to be true. Their minds are darkened. They're groping in a darkness because they refuse to turn on the light that has come in the world through Christ. They claim to be wise, but they're fools. They confer on each other PhDs in foolishness, Paul says. And as a result of that, they reach conclusions that are utterly wrong, utterly specious, and yet they congratulate themselves repeatedly on what great insights they think they have achieved. Claiming to be wise, they become fools. They exchange the glory of God for images resembling mortal men, birds, four-footed animals, creeping things. A person has to say that given that the great knowledge of God has been revealed to us, for individuals to then take the artifacts of this world, sticks and stones, and actually put them in the place of God, and say, I'm going to worship this thing, which is the production of my own creative energies, rather than the God who indeed created me, is the height of foolishness. We may call it all kinds of sophisticated names. We may give it all sorts of very kind and appreciative titles. But the fact of the matter is that at the end of the day, this is a colossal activity of pure futility. And that seems to be Paul's description of it. So the first leg of the journey here is what we're calling revelation. And the revelation comes to us. Here Paul means generally. It's general information about God. It comes to all people. But people refuse to acknowledge it. They refuse to bow the knee to the God who is disclosed to them in this act of revelation. And they engage rather in rebellion. And that's the second of my three R's. It's the only one we're as far as we're going to get in our discussion today. But here Paul talks about the way in which this rebellious activity begins to take place. And that starts in verse 24. And you'll notice that this movement here is in three parts. And this rebellion in each case begins with Paul actually using words that are rather remarkable in their content because they had a particular meaning to the people to whom Paul was originally writing. He says, therefore, God gave them up. And then again in verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up. And then finally in verse 28, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up. God gave them up. God gave them up. God gave them up. Now, while I'm calling this rebellion, there's another way you could think about it, which may be more to the point. This language that says God gave them up is actually the same language that would have been used in the ancient world to describe someone being given over for judgment. God gave them up for judgment. God gave them up to punishment, would be the idea. If someone were going to be delivered to prison, then they would be given up to the prison guard or to the executioner, if that were the penalty they were facing. There is a very strong idea throughout this text that God is delivering them over to judgment. And so if the first part of this is their treason against the revelation, then in a sense, the rebellion we're describing here is at the same time God's punishment of them. If I could put it this way, God punishes them by giving them over to their own lusts and desires for evil. This is sometimes called in the Bible judgment in kind. It's when we are judged by being given the very thing that we wanted. The very thing we lusted for becomes the form of prison in which we are cast. Somebody may decide that they want to drink. They want to drink alcohol. I'm not opposed to drinking alcohol, by the way, but someone may decide to just give themselves over to that and wake up one day and realize that they are addicted, that they are unable to stop, that this thing they wanted to do has become the judgment that is binding them like a straitjacket. People can be addicted to all kinds of forms of vice that actually imprison them, whether it's pornography or various kinds of immorality. Drug use and so on, all of these things can become forms of addiction. But in a sense, at the heart of all of it is a kind of addiction that comes because God gave us up to the alternative to worshiping Him. It comes in three forms. You may notice God gave them up to lust. People can be addicted to the lusts of their heart, in which as they refuse to honor God, they find themselves tied up in these things that they have put in the place of the worship of God. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served nature, the creature, rather than the Creator. Nature worship, in which I say, I'm not going to worship the God who created nature, I'm rather going to worship nature itself. And how much of that describes the religious activity that we find among human beings in this world, in which they take some aspect of nature and put it in the place of God and worship that instead of God, and then discover after a while that that object of worship has indeed become their prison, and they are unable to escape it. The next one, beginning in verse 26, God gave them to degraded passions. And here Paul, of course, uses as his great example of this homosexual behavior. He says, God gave them to degrading passions. Their women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural. In the same way, also men giving up natural intercourse with the woman were consumed in passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. If the first form of rebellion was the worship of nature, you might say the second form is anti-nature. And that seems to be the reason Paul is using it here. He actually uses the phrase against nature. They are acting contrary to the fundamental created order. And that becomes a further form of addiction. Anti-nature may be exemplified this, or it may be exemplified by other things. The point Paul is driving at here is that we're entering into a kind of spiral downward in which our refusal to acknowledge God has plunged us into the miserable addiction to things that are ultimately destructive, but we cannot free ourselves from them. We have become tied up by them. They control us. They seize the very heart and keep us from the true and genuine freedom that we would otherwise enjoy. The final form of addiction that Paul describes here is in verse 28. Since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind, doing things that should not be done. And basically, the list of things that he gives here, you have to say the sort of common denominator that ties them all together is that we are given over to those things that are finally destructive. That these are destructive of human happiness, of human health, destructive of human emotion, of human affection. All of these things go down the tubes as we give ourselves over to that, worshiping that which is not God. Since they didn't see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them all, gave them over to wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, envy, murder, strife, deceit, craftiness, gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, rebellious toward parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those that practice such things deserve to die, yet they not only do them, but even applaud others who practice them. This is the insanity of the effects of refusing to acknowledge the truth of God that is plainly set before us, the God that we see in general revelation, the God who is holy, the God who has set forth His own qualities such that we are warranted in recognizing Him and worshiping Him. When we turn from Him, we do so to our own destruction. We thought we would be free by refusing to acknowledge God. The deep, profound irony of the matter is that this quest for freedom creates a vastly worse form of slavery than anything we could have imagined. And the only true source of freedom that might have been available, the freedom that comes by acknowledging this God who is our Creator and submitting ourselves to Him, is forfeited because we refuse to acknowledge Him. Paul wants to give us in the book of Romans a great message of liberty, a great message of freedom. But of course, the alternative to that is if we refuse this God, we plunge ourselves into the despair of a kind of prison of our own making. And that seems to be the fundamental message that's given to us in this first chapter of Romans. The thing that we have left is to notice that while there is this judgment that we have that could be called a kind of temporal judgment, a judgment that is produced by our own bad behavior, there is still another judgment to come. This that we might call eternal judgment, and that's going to be the topic we'll take up in our next discussion when we start off in chapter 2. Because not only do we have this temporal judgment that comes by virtue of the prison of our own creation that we've just been describing, but we have an even worse judgment that comes by virtue of the fact that God is still waiting on Judgment Day to confront us and examine us for the lives we've lived. And so we'll turn our attention to that great truth the next time we're together. And until then, it's been a delight to have you here with us, and we'll continue next time.